This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLING soap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Week 8 of the NFL season is upon us, and it is time for us to revisit and relive some of the greatest and most memorable games in the history of the National Football League. Hello once again, sports fans. This is Dana Augusta once again for the Historically Speaking NFL Matchups, where we once again highlight the best of pro football from back in the day. If you are returning, welcome back. And you already know what we do here on these mini episodes. Those of you that are new, we examine a few games that are on the NFL schedule that are rematches of famous games from years past. This is our way of getting you ready for NFL action for the weekend. Now if there is a theme for the games this weekend, it would be rivalry week, as these four games could be considered rivalry games in one form or fashion. Two of them are long-standing rivalries that are part of the firmament of the history of the league. The first that we're going to talk about is the feud between the Cowboys and 49ers. Now, everyone knows the catch and the many instances in the 1990s they met for the NFC title. But the game that we're going to talk about is a playoff game from the early 1970s that saw the Cowboys erase a 17-point deficit by a quote-unquote backup quarterback to hand the Niners another postseason defeat. The second is a rivalry that started in the American Football League, and it was appropriate that these two teams would meet in the very last AFL championship game right before the AFL and NFL would merge in 1970. And about a week before that final AFL title game, there was an NFL playoff game that started one of the great postseason rivalries that would dominate the decade of the 1970s in the NFC. And finally, one of the oldest games that we would talk about in this series. It is still considered to be one of the biggest blowouts in NFL history. We have all of that going on here in this NFL historical matchups for week 8 of here on the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, where we talk about the best of sports from back in the day. On December 23rd, 1972, and if that date sounds familiar, it should. Earlier that day in the AFC Divisional Playoffs, the Pittsburgh Steelers defeated the Oakland Raiders for their first ever playoff win thanks to what is forever known as the Immaculate Reception. In the late game that Saturday before Christmas would be the NFC Divisional Playoff game between the Dallas Cowboys, the defending Super Bowl champions, taking on the San Francisco 49ers for the third year in a row in the playoffs. In the second ever postseason game ever held at Candlestick Park, the Cowboys were looking to return to the Super Bowl and eliminate the 49ers for the third straight year. But it would be the 49ers that would strike first right out of the gate. Vic Washington would return the opening kickoff 97 yards to open the scoring for the 49ers. On the next drive, the Cowboys would answer with a Tony Fritsch field goal to make the score 7-3. The score would remain 7-3 despite the 49ers missing a golden opportunity to extend the lead. After a 52-yard pass to receiver Gene Washington, Cowboys cornerback Charlie Waters would intercept John Brody's pass at the 1-yard line, denying the Niners a score. However, on the next drive, Dallas Cowboy quarterback Craig Morton would fumble the ball and would be recovered by San Francisco linebacker Ed Beard on the Dallas 15. And this time, the Niners would take full advantage as Larry Schreiber would score on a 1-yard touchdown run to make the score 14-3. Morton's struggles would continue. Late in the period, Morton would be intercepted by linebacker Skip Vanderbunt on the Dallas 32-yard line, which set up Schreiber's second rushing touchdown, extending the 49ers' score to 21-3 late in the first half. Yet Morton and the Cowboys will respond, leading Dallas to a field goal, and right before halftime, Morton would find Lance Allworth on a 28-yard touchdown to make the score 21-13 at halftime. In the second half, the Niners had a chance to extend the lead even further, but Bruce Gossett would miss a 40-yard field goal that ultimately would come back to haunt the Niners. Later in the period, with the Cowboys pinned deep in their own territory, 49er defensive tackle Charlie Kruger stripped the ball from Cowboys running back Calvin Hill and recovered it in the end zone for a touchdown. With the extra point, San Francisco had a commanding 28-13 lead late in the third quarter and appeared to be heading to the NFC Championship game once again. At that moment, Coach Tom Landry replaced Morton with the previous year's Super Bowl MVP, Roger Staubach, who was injured earlier in the year and lost his starting job to Morton. Yet in the beginning, it didn't seem to help. On Staubach's first drive, he lost a fumble while being tackled by Bob Hoskins. San Francisco was in prime position now to put the game away with another score, but he couldn't get the ball into the end zone, and Gossett missed his second field goal, this one 32 yards out, causing a huge reversal of momentum. Now with the ball, Hill ripped off a 48-yard gain for the Cowboys on a draw play, which set up Tony Fritch's 27-yard field goal, trimming the lead to 28-16. Later in the quarter, after a poor Dallas punt, Dallas had the ball first and 10 at the 49ers 45-yard line, and then Staubach led the team to the end zone, completing two passes to fullback Walt Garrison. Then with less than 2 minutes remaining, Staubach found wide receiver Billy Parks for a 20-yard touchdown completion to cut the score to 28-23. On the ensuing kickoff, Fritch, who is a former Austrian soccer player, pulled off a successful onside kick. 49er receiver Preston Riley had the ball for a brief second, but couldn't hold on. Hall of Fame defensive back Mel Renfro for the Cowboys would recover the ball, keeping them alive. On the first play after the recovery, Staubach gained 21 yards on a quarterback scramble. Then he completed another 19-yard pass to Parks, who ran out of bounds at the San Francisco 10. On the very next play, Staubach threw a 10-yard touchdown pass to Ron Sellers, giving Dallas a 30-28 lead with just 52 seconds remaining. However, the 49ers were not out of the game. Needing only a field goal to win, Brody completed three consecutive passes, but on the third one, a 23-yard completion to Riley that would have put the 49ers well within Goss's range, it was called back for a holding penalty. On the very next play, Brody would be intercepted for the second time by Charlie Waters, thus claiming the 30-28 win for the Cowboys as Staubach performed his first miracle comeback as Cowboys quarterback. In limited action, Staubach went 12 of 20 for 172 yards, 2 touchdowns, and 23 rushing yards in a little over a quarter of action. The 18-point deficit was the biggest comeback in NFL postseason history at the time, and this game sort of marked the turning point in the history of the league if you really think about it. The Cowboys would go on the next week and lose to Washington in the NFC Championship game, yet the Cowboys would be a perennial contender in the NFL throughout the remainder of the decade of the 1970s. As for the 49ers, it would be their last postseason appearance until 1981, led by some guy named Joe Montana. When you think of the heyday of the American Football League, two things usually come to mind. First, you think of high-flying offense, a lot of passing, and ridiculously high scores. And the second thing that enters your mind, well, at least for me, the bitter rivalry between the Oakland Raiders and the Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs and Raiders, the winners of the last two of the last three AFL championships, would meet up on January 4th, 1970 in the final AFL championship game before the leagues would officially merge with the NFL. This game will be a hard-fought defensive struggle with both teams eyeing their appearance in Super Bowl IV in New Orleans. The Chiefs had a little extra incentive to beat their rivals. The Raiders not only had won their two games with the Chiefs in the regular season, but Oakland had beaten Kansas City in seven of their last eight games, including a 41-6 beatdown the season before in the AFL playoffs. In the beginning of this game, it looked as though much would be the same, as the Raiders got going early. A key completion from quarterback Daryl LaMonica to receiver Warren Wells of 24 yards placed the ball at the Kansas City 3. From there, running back Charlie Smith finished the Raider drive that went 66 yards to give the Raiders an early 7-0 lead. And then from there, it was the defenses that took control of the game, limiting both offenses. However, late in the second quarter, the Chiefs offense finally got going. With 3 minutes and 24 seconds on the clock in the first half, the Chiefs, who had only gained 2 first downs to this point, drove 75 yards thanks to a 14-yard completion to Otis Taylor from Lynn Dawson. Then, after the 2-minute warning, Dawson found fellow Southern University alum Frank Pitts for a 41-yard completion, placing the ball at the 1-yard line. From there, it was Wendell Hayes with a 1-yard touchdown run, tying the game at 7 as both teams trudged into halftime. In the second half, the Raiders were looking to respond to the Chiefs' score. Yet during the first drive of the second half, LaMonica had jammed his thumb on the helmet of Chiefs defensive end Aaron Brown and was lost for the remainder of the third quarter. LaMonica was then placed by George Blanda. Blanda continued the drive, but he would end up stalling when Chiefs defensive back Emmett Thomas intercepted Blanda at the 5-yard line. For many years to come, the Raiders would be victimized by controversial calls that would change the course of games, and coming up would be the first one of consequence to happen to the Silver and Black that would start a dubious trend. Facing a 3rd and 13, Dawson would seem to have completed a 35-yard pass to Otis Taylor along the Chiefs sideline in triple coverage. The key words there are, would seem to have. Upon further review, Taylor not only had 1 foot in bounds, and to add insult to injury, replay showed that Taylor didn't even have full control of the ball as he was striding out of bounds. Of course, this was long before instant replay, and the officials simply missed it. That would be the spark that would carry the Chiefs to New Orleans. The 95-yard drive would be capped off with a 1-yard touchdown run by fullback Robert Tank Holmes, along with myself, another great fellow alum from Southern University. LaMonica would return to the game in the fourth quarter, but the famed Raider precision passing game would be hindered with his injured thumb. Jan Stenerud would add a field goal in the fourth quarter to give the Chiefs a 17-7 win and berth in the Super Bowl IV, where they would dismantle the Vikings 23-7 in the first Super Bowl ever in New Orleans. Speaking of the Vikings, on December 27, 1969, just 1 week prior to the aforementioned Chiefs-Raiders AFL Championship game, the Los Angeles Rams traveled to cold and snowy Metropolitan Stadium in Bloomington, Minnesota for their matchup with the Minnesota Vikings in the NFL playoffs. Along with the weather conditions, experts predicted that this would be a defensive struggle considering that the Rams and Vikings had two of the best defenses in the NFL. The Rams, of course, had the great defensive line, the fearsome foursome, while the Vikings' defense was known as the Purple People Eaters. Yet it became a sort of a high-scoring game. The Rams were led by that year's league MVP Roman Gabriel at quarterback, while the Vikings had quarterback Joe Capp, who felt right at home in the cold Minnesota air considering he was a top-notch quarterback in the Canadian Football League several years earlier. The Rams got the first big break of the game as Viking fullback Bill Brown fumbled and safety Richie Pettibon recovered for the Vikings on the Vikings 41-45 yard line. From there, Gabriel would lead the Rams primarily on the ground to the Viking 3, ending the drive with a 3-yard touchdown pass to Bob Klein for an early 7-0 lead. But the Vikings would quickly respond. Cap completed 4 consecutive passes on a 10-play, 75-yard drive, including a 27-yard completion to Gene Washington, placing the ball on the LA 4. The drive ended when Viking running back Dave Osborne dove over the goal line for a Viking touchdown, tying the score at 7 apiece with just a little over 3 minutes remaining in the first quarter. In the second quarter, Gabriel continued to riddle the Viking defense, leading to a Bruce Gossett field goal, making the score 10-7. Bruce Gossett, where have I heard that name before? Anyway, the next time the Rams got the ball, Gabriel would lead the Rams to a touchdown thanks to a couple of completions to tight end Billy Truax. The Gabriel to Truax combination ended the 13-play, 65-yard drive with a 2-yard touchdown pass, giving the Rams a 17-7 lead at halftime as the Rams scored on their first 4 possessions of the game. In the second half, Viking coach Bud Grant adjusted his defense to stop the Rams tight end, and his Purple People Eaters continued to punish the Ram running game. They also got increasing pressure on Gabriel. On offense, Grant neutralized the Ram pass rush by having quarterback Joe Capp run the ball either on design plays like quarterback draws or rollouts, or by instructing him to take off and run at the first sign of pressure. And Capp began frustrating the Rams with runs, and this threat caused their pass rush to be less aggressive. After forcing the Rams to punt for the first time in the game on the opening possession of the second half, Cap completed a 41-yard pass to Washington on the LA 12-yard line. And after a Rams penalty and a 5-yard run by Cap, Osborne finished the drive with a 1-yard touchdown run that cut Minnesota's deficit to 17-14. Osborne's second touchdown of the afternoon. The third quarter quickly became a defensive struggle, and both teams had drives end in turnovers. The only points for the remainder of the period was a Bruce Gossett 27-yard field goal to make the score 20-14 with the Rams in control. In the fourth, Cap finally solved the Rams' defense by driving the Vikes 65 yards with 40 of them coming in the air. Cap would finish the drive himself with a 2-yard touchdown run around left end to give the Vikings the lead for the first time 21-20 as he dove into the crowd on hand standing along the sideline. What an indelible picture that was, if you know what I'm talking about. Then the Vikings defense came up big on the next series. After the kickoff team tackled Rams returner Ron Smith on the 12-yard line, Hall of Famer defensive end Carl Eller sacked Gabriel in the end zone for a safety, making the score 23-20. And with the Rams needing a field goal to tie to go to sudden death, it would be the Rams' hopes for victory would be dashed suddenly. With Gabriel driving the ball into Viking territory with less than a minute to play, his pass was tipped at the line of scrimmage and was intercepted by Alan Page to seal the Vikings' very first ever postseason win, the Vikings winning 23-20 and giving birth to the great Rams-Vikings rivalry that we would know and love so much through the decade of the 1970s. It was Championship Sunday on December 8, 1940 at Griffith Stadium in Washington, D.C., where the 8-3 Chicago Bears, champions of the NFL Western Division, were taking on the homestanding Washington Redskins, title holders from the East, with a record of 9-2 on the season. It was a rematch of an earlier season game that saw Washington beat Chicago 7-3 just 3 weeks earlier. And after the game, Redskins owner George Preston Marshall told reporters that the Bears were, quote, crybabies and quitters when the going got tough, unquote. Before the championship game, Bears head coach George Halas showed his players what the Washington owner said about his team to inspire them. Halas told them, gentlemen, this is what George Preston Marshall thinks of you. I think you are a great team. Now go out there and prove it. Helping the Bears' cause, Halas consulted Stanford head coach Clark Shaughnessy and helped devise a game plan to counter Washington's shifting linebackers. The Bears controlled the game right from the start using the T formation as their primary offensive strategy, and on the second play from scrimmage, Bears running back Bill Osmanski ran 68 yards for a touchdown, and the route was on. On Washington's first drive of the game, quarterback Sammy Baugh led his offense all the way to the Chicago 26. Then wide receiver Charlie Moore dropped a sure touchdown pass in the end zone that would have tied the game. Washington would attempt a field goal on fourth down and sailed wide of the target, and the Redskins would not get any closer. Later in the first quarter, Bears Hall of Fame quarterback Sid Luckman would score on a one-yard touchdown followed by Joe McMancini's 42-yard scoring run to make the score 21-0 at the end of the opening quarter. By halftime, it was 28-0, and it would get far worse for Washington. With mainly backups in the second half, the Bears would score 45 points as Chicago would win the 1940 NFL Championship game with the incredible score of 73-0. In total, the Bears would roll up 501 yards of offense with 382 of them on the ground. The defense recorded 8 interceptions with 3 of those returned for touchdowns. The best quote from this game actually came from the losing quarterback, Sammy Baugh. A reporter asked in the locker room after the game, "Do you think the game would have been different if Malone had not dropped that game-tying interception in that game-tying touchdown pass in the first quarter?" Paul reportedly quipped, "Sure, it would have been different. The final score would have been 73-7." And that will do it for the Week 8 edition of the Historically Speaking NFL Matchups mini-episode. Thanks you guys once again for listening. We'll try to come out with these mini-episodes every week during the NFL regular season. Yeah, I know I missed last week. It's a bye week. We'll try to come out with these mini-episodes every week during the NFL regular season, highlighting great and memorable games from the long history of the National Football League. And as usual, this podcast comes to you from the Bill King, my idol, the Bill King Memorial Studio here in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises located in suburban Atlanta, which is in the shadow of Stone Mountain. To get more content of the Historically Speaking Sports podcast, you can check us out on Twitter X at HistoricallySP2, or you can send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the show. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors. Hell, tell a passerby on the street about us if you think they may like sports history. And until the next episode, please, y'all, stay blessed, stay cool, be your best at everything you do, and it can make the world a much, much better place. And remember, those of you that are listening in the United States, vote. Whoever you want to vote for, just vote. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Peace out.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.